From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's increasingly hard for a Catholic of any nationality to find his or her place in a fragmented church, writes Barbara Grizzuti Harrison. On today's Fresh Air, Harrison talks with us about traveling through Italy, searching for her place in the church. Also today, Ellen Goodman tells us how she started combining the personal and the political on the op-ed page. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz compares different interpretations of the same compositions and asks what makes a performance definitive. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from Thomas McGuane. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce refused to answer questions today from a House panel investigating billions of dollars in fraud during the Reagan administration. Pierce cited his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. The panel is looking into charges that, among other things, Pierce steered lucrative federal housing contracts to friends and business associates. Pierce says he's been prejudged by the subcommittee. He also invoked House rules that force subcommittee Chairman Tom Lantos to bar television, radio, and photo coverage, despite the chairman's complaint that the move is unwarranted. The White House today indicated it will go along with the proposed Senate compromise for funding the war on drugs. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more from the White House.
The Senate plan would add some $900 million to the president's proposal. However, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said it would still be consistent with the administration's objectives. Fitzwater said the president expected to accept the arrangement and that hopefully the nation could get on with implementing the drug plan. The plan would raise to $8.8 billion the amount of money spent on the drug war in the fiscal year that begins in 5 days. The money will be raised by making across-the-board cuts of nearly 0.5% in other federal programs. Nearly all the new money, $800 of the $900 million, will be used for drug treatment, education, and prevention, areas that the Democrats charged were seriously underfunded in the Bush plan. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Two Americans were killed in an ambush in the Philippines today. The incident occurred just a couple of hours before Vice President Dan Quayle arrived in Manila. Details from NPR's Neil Conan.
The victims are William Thompson and Donald Buckner, civilian contractors who worked for Ford Aerospace on electronic warfare simulators at the Crow Valley Gunnery Range, about 60 miles north of Manila. A local police spokesman said they were on their way back to Clark Air Base when they were ambushed by six men. Their bodies were heavily mangled, the spokesman said. 69 spent cartridges were found at the scene. Police say the communist New People's Army is probably responsible for the shooting. Last April, the group murdered U.S. Army Colonel James Nick Rowe near Manila. Vice President Quayle is scheduled to meet President Corazon Aquino and tour U.S. military bases Wednesday. Here in Washington, a State Department spokesman denounced the killings as a cowardly act of terrorism. This is Neil Conan reporting.
The Senate today endorsed an additional cut of nearly $300 million in President Bush's Star Wars program as part of a $288 billion military spending bill. Earlier in the day, the Senate overwhelmingly endorsed shutting down 86 military bases. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 4.5 points to close at 2663.94. This is NPR News. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze today called for total destruction of Soviet and U.S. chemical weapons. The call goes a step further than President Bush, who yesterday offered an 80% reduction. Shevardnadze also called for the halt of all further production of chemical weapons even before a worldwide chemical arms ban is concluded. The White House said today President Bush welcomes the Soviet counteroffer. Hungary's parliament passed a new immigration law today that brings the country in line with Western nations. The measures are likely to please Washington, but the Bush administration has been pressing Hungary to adopt laws that allow its citizens to travel freely. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Budapest.
The new immigration law passed almost unanimously today. Parliamentary members spoke of the basic human right of freedom of travel. For years, it was difficult for Hungarians to legally immigrate. Passports were valid for only 90 days of travel to the West. The new law is in keeping with the Helsinki Accord, signed by Hungary in the 1970s, that guarantees freedom of movement. In another first, four non-communist members took their seats in parliament today. The parliament has been controlled by the country's Communist Party for more than 40 years. While Hungary is scheduled for its first freely contested parliamentary election early next year, a few free by-elections brought opposition candidates to the parliament for this session. Today, they announced they were forming an official opposition bloc. In Budapest, this is Deborah Amos.
About 100 East Germans filed out of Bonn's embassy in Prague today after an East Berlin lawyer promised they would be allowed to emigrate within 6 months if they returned home. An Iranian delegate to the OPEC meeting in Geneva said today his country has set forth new proposals in an attempt to break the cartel's stalemate over an agreement on output quotas. The offer would give some of the 13 OPEC members bigger percentage rises on their assigned quotas than others, an idea that has met resistance in the past. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To change one's place is to change one's nature, writes Barbara Grizzuti Harrison, and that's one of the reasons she travels. Harrison recently spent several months traveling through Italy. Her new book, Italian Days, is part travelogue, part memoir. She writes about the architecture, the food, the traffic, but at the heart of the book is her search for family and faith. Harrison's parents left Italy at the turn of the century. She was raised in Brooklyn as a Jehovah's Witness, a subject she wrote about in her book, Visions of Glory. Years after she left the Witnesses, she became a Roman Catholic. On this trip to Italy, she tracked down her Italian relatives and tried to find her place in the church. Harrison's other books include Unlearning the Lie, Sexism in School. Her essays, reviews, and profiles have been published in the New York Times, Harper's, The Nation, Ms., and Esquire. During part of her trip through Italy, she was joined by her daughter. The rest of the time, Harrison traveled alone. I asked her if she enjoys traveling by herself.
Very much. I'm never lonely when I'm alone. And this is probably extremely self-centered unless you think of a city as a character, not just as having character, but as being a character, as being an object of love. I like relating in a very intimate way to the city as an entity. And I find even with wonderful and good friends and companionable travelers, that my attention keeps getting divided and shifted between the person and the city, and I truly do prefer to be alone in the places I best love.
You said that in Italy you never felt so much made in God's image. Would you explain that?
I think because in Italy God seems to be part of the family. He doesn't seem to be remote. He just certainly doesn't seem to be punishing. And one, first of all, Italy is so physically beautiful that I always think of something Louise Bogen, the poet, said. She said, if there is no God, why is the universe not dark brown? Italy is certainly not dark brown. And there are reminders of God and of his extended family, and in particular of Mary, all over the place. And I don't by that mean only the great cathedrals. I mean street shrines, which are to me enormously touching. You know, people put flowers in beet jars in these rather homely street shrines, some of which, by the way, are Renaissance masterpieces, others of which are folk art. But one feels as if one is living in a very God-filled world, and one recognizes oneself in great paintings. One sees oneself in some role. One sees one's grandmother, one's aunt, one's mother, one's baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Rome, you wanted to find your place in the church, so you literally went shopping for a church. Before we get to the one that felt most comfortable to you, what did you find in certain churches that were alienating to you?
Well, you know, you may know, Terry, that a lot of Catholics have a very hard time these days feeling very much at home in any given parish, and I sometimes think that the heroic Catholics are those who go to their neighborhood church and sort of live through a homily about how we need a new roof, while at the same time thousands have died in a hurricane in Sicily or someplace, or live through a liturgy in which women seem not to exist. These are, of course, things of concern to me. I believe absolutely in what an Italian friend of mine, who is an iconoclast and a great disbeliever, calls the story, by which he means, and I mean, the fact that God became man, became human, shared our human condition, died, and was resurrected. I believe that absolutely. But I don't like an awful lot of priests, and I don't like the feeling in an awful lot of churches. And so in Italy, I think, and I think now out of a great deal of vanity and stupidity, I looked for what I wanted. What I didn't like, may I tell you what I didn't like?
Yes, please.
I didn't like the American church, which is to say the expatriate church. I realize that American expatriates need a social center, but I think the danger is it becomes parochial and they talk only to one another. People are perfectly capable of loving Italy for 20 years and never learning a word of the language. And I thought it was in some ways small and petty. I am made very much uncomfortable by charismatics. I always think I'm going to need Valium when people start talking in tongues or having ecstatic experiences. I think ecstatic experiences are something that should be kept very quiet and very private. So that rule, and of course I don't, I would, it would be impossible for me to go to, not impossible, I would do it because the heart of the church is the Mass, and I suppose I could bring myself to do it. But if it were particularly sexist, I would be extremely unhappy. What I wound up doing was going to a neighborhood church. Now, I had the advantage of not understanding every word that was being said. But I liked those neighborhood churches. I thought, well, this church is meaningless. I am going here to celebrate Mass. And so that's what I did, and I stopped feeling restless after a while.
What was the scale of the church? Was it a large church? Was it small? Was it modest? Was it filled with art and with shrines?
It was rather small, but you know, to say that means we're talking about Rome now, are we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was rather small, but to say that means almost nothing because in one dim corner there is a Caravaggio, so in that way it was magnificent. But it was friendly, and it was, you know, the Italians use church as if it were a living room. They walk up and down, they talk with their friends, they cup their mouths with their hands and comment on the puerility of the homily. They ask for alms. And there's this, again, kind of familial relationship with God, which I found rather cheery and comforting and nice.
You visited many cathedrals while you were in Italy. And you raise a question that I think is a really interesting and a really important one about cathedrals. Does the scale, the massive scale of a cathedral, uplift and exalt the soul, bring it closer to God, or does it reduce you to feeling the size of an atom and feeling small and unnecessarily insignificant?
It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, it's a question that's been vexed by better people than me. Dickens talked about this a lot. Hawthorne talked about this a lot. Henry James, of course, was obsessed by this question, and often staged scenes in cathedrals, I think, precisely in order to answer this question. I think I came to think that it really depended entirely on the cathedral. You know, during the Counter-Reformation, a lot, at the beginning of the Counter-Reformation, a lot of the cathedrals were emptied of many of their art treasures and many of the statues. And so they became, to my mind, these bare and sterile places where not only did I feel insignificant, I don't mind feeling insignificant, of course I am insignificant, certainly compared to God, but I felt agoraphobic. And I don't mind feeling insignificant, but I do mind feeling agoraphobic. I don't feel that way in some of the busier cathedrals, busy with art, busy with people, busy with candles, busy with light, busy with stained glass and wonderful light and air that's almost chewable. It's so dense with color. But I don't, you know, this question of feeling insignificant is an interesting one because it is sometimes exactly at the point at which you feel that you are nothing, that you are compared not only to God or to the church, but certainly compared to art, compared to the weight of history you feel around you. It's exactly at that point where you feel your own lack of significance that you simultaneously feel exalted and happy and very much part of that, so that the distinction is then eroded. And the question of significance and insignificance almost becomes mooted. It disappears. Does that make any sense?
I think it makes a lot of sense. Barbara Grizzuti Harrison is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of her new book, Italian Days, which is part travel guide and part memoir about her recent trip to Italy. Where do you go to church in New York? I mean, you don't have to name the church, but you were talking before about the difference between shopping for a church or just going to the neighborhood church.
Well, I'm out of town a lot, and this is a way of hedging, because I'm having the same problems in New York of finding a church, and perhaps I should just resign myself to going to the one two blocks away from me. I might very well do that. I think if one starts looking for the perfect liturgy and wonderful music and a progressive-minded priest and stuff like that, that sometimes one just gets in trouble, because after all, part of the thing about church is community, and your community doesn't exist in the most beautiful church in New York, which happens to be a $25 taxi ride away from you. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm shopping again after swearing I never would.
Okay. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Barbara Grizzuti-Harrison. Her new book, Italian Days, is part travel guide, part personal memoir. She's also a journalist who's written profiles for The New York Times, Harper's Vanity Fair, and Ms. Magazine. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Barbara Grizzuti-Harrison is my guest. You know, we're talking about churches, but you're really, in a way, a convert to the Roman Catholic Church. When you were growing up, you were a Jehovah's Witness.
It's like saying I was a teenage werewolf. I don't know if...
How do you mean that?
Well, I mean, it's an aberrant sect, isn't it? Or so it seems to me now. It's joyless. There was a wonderful line that Dorothy Sayers, who was, I think, an Episcopalian, no, she was Church of England, said, and that was the only sin that love can commit is to be joyless. And do you know the only holiday they celebrate is the death of Christ, not even the resurrection, but the death of Christ, and they do that by having a very rather glum and grim meeting. So for me, I know for so many people who were raised, people of my generation who were raised in the Catholic Church, the Church seems restraining, confining, repressive. For me, it is, of course, it was enormously emancipating, because I grew up so straitjacketed in a sect that told me what to do every moment of the day, censored my thoughts, my dreams, everything. And so becoming a Catholic, and I must say that I was baptized as a Catholic as a child, so maybe it took like a vaccination. In that sense, I'm no more convert than everybody who makes the decision every day to be whatever he or she is. Becoming a Catholic for me was really opening a door into freedom. I mean, I can disagree with people. I can disagree with the priest, a bishop, and the pope, and nobody can do anything to me except disapprove.
What could they do to you when you were a Jehovah's Witness?
They could excommunicate me, which they call disfellowshipping. They could impose upon my mother the imperative never to speak to me. They could dictate to everyone who knew me not to talk to me. And in fact, at my mother's funeral, nobody did talk to me.
Were your parents Jehovah's Witnesses?
My mother, whom I've learned to love since she died, was, and my father was not.
So you were brought up as a witness?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how did you leave? When did you leave?
I left with great difficulty. I was 22. I had been a Jehovah's Witness since I was 9. I worked in their headquarters building doing jobs that women did then, which is to say I made 30 beds a day and washed 15 floors a day and stuff like that. And work which a disaffected Catholic will, of course, say nuns do too. So it wasn't the nature of the work so much as the fact that I wasn't allowed to think a thing. And it was sort of like what I would imagine living in a communist country 10 years ago might have been. If one had a doubt, one couldn't tell anybody because you'd be turned in. I forgot your other question. How did I leave? Oh, I went a little nuts. I mean, I just became so unhappy that even I noticed it. And this is very odd. These are these wonderful serendipitous things that happen in one's life, and one doesn't know how to account for them. I went to get glasses. The doctor said, I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're seeing things that aren't there. You're not seeing things that are there. Whatever you're doing, get out. And so I did.
So you left a religion that you found to be both all-encompassing and punishing.
Yes, indeed.
Did you go for an extended period of time before getting going back to religion through the Roman Catholic Church?
Many, many, many years. I don't know if I can even... when I say many years, I mean almost 20 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah, sure it is. Yeah, I had two wonderful kids. As far as I knew, I was wonderfully happy. No, that's not true. I was, you know... I was okay. Wonderfully happy sounds too Mary Poppins. I didn't understand that what had happened, and this is what I think in retrospect, was that the Jehovah's Witnesses had created a need that they'd never filled and they'd never satisfied. I mean, there was still a need for God. Goodness, I sound so religious.
Well, are you? I mean,
am I? I'm not pious. I mean, I think anybody who had ever heard my confession would tell you I was not a very good person. But I'm answering your questions, and they seem to be taking us in that direction.
Barbara Gazzutti Harrison is my guest, and her new book is called Italian Days, and it's about a recent trip to Italy, in which the book is part travelogue, part personal memoir, and religion is one of the many issues that she discusses in the book. Part of the reason for your trip was to look for distant relatives. Your parents were from Italy. And you wanted to meet some of the people who were still there, part of the family tree. I think it must have been really a kind of unusual experience to see people who had the same genetic pool but were living completely different lives.
You're not kidding. I mean, because when does those tricks with one's mind, well, suppose I had not been born here, suppose I'd been born there, and you go through this whole list of logical impossibilities, trying to imagine what your life would be like under an olive tree in a courtyard with chickens running around. It is dislocating, disorienting, and ultimately extremely satisfying. I'm not even sure, although I've written about it at great length, in what way that too fills a great need to see yourself reflected in another culture. It's almost like finding a lost part of yourself, a part that's been split off or a part that's been behind a kind of curtain. I saw myself in those people. I loved them very easily. Their love was so forthright, so simple, so sweet, so easily given. And that was amazing to me after the guardedness, the insularity, this almost claustrophobic kind of feeling I got very often from my Italo-American relatives. I'm not sure that Italians always transplant well, by the way. And as you may imagine, I have Bensonhurst somewhere tucked in the back of my mind.
Did your Italian relatives not understand why your family left Italy?
No, they did not. They certainly did not. And you know, I'm not sure I do either. Well, I mean, one knows all the obvious reasons. They were very, very, very poor. Think how poor you'd have to be to leave the Bay of Naples for Jersey City. I mean, you have to be really poor. But no, they had it was incomprehensible to them because their world, my Italian relatives, their world is narrow, which is not to say it's not deep, but it has certain very set boundaries. And this alien activity of leaving one's homeland seems to them a kind of affront, and they're wounded by it. They understand that there is another world, but they don't quite understand why anybody would want to know it any more intimately than they need it. They have what they want. They are craftsmen. They make and they carve. They make cheese. They make wine. These are indeed wholesome and wonderful activities. It seems to them that there is nothing better to do. And no, they don't understand. They understand that we come back looking different and smelling different and saying weird things.
Have what they want. They have what they want. I bet that's something that you're really not used to experiencing, right? Someone who's always thinking about, should I shop for another church or go to the one in my neighborhood, you know?
No, I don't have it. And I mean, modern life is not conducive
to
this kind of mindset. Exactly. I don't know anybody who has what he or she wants.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, I mean, you never even know what it is that you want.
Yeah. That's the first problem.
It's one of the basic dilemmas.
Yeah.
Italy is such an old country. One of the things that I think is really interesting traveling across America is to, say, compare parts of Florida and New York or parts of Los Angeles and New York, and you have this comparison between the old and the new. And you go to Italy, which is far older than, say, America's oldest cities.
Yeah.
What kind of experience do you get from being in a city that's very, very old?
The same kind, and I hope you understand that this is not morbid, the same kind of experience I feel in a graveyard or a cemetery, which is a rather comforting one. I mean, one just thinks of life as a continuum and death as part of it. And it goes on, and one has a place both in life and in death. Even the landscape, you know, in Italy is old. Even, for example, in Tuscany, one feels everything is willed. There is nothing arbitrary about the embroidery of the kilns with cypresses and grapevines and olive trees. They didn't do it that way to look pretty. They did it that way over thousands of years because that was the way to cultivate the land. So that you begin to feel almost as if even where a cloud falls between mountains, that the cloud has volition. And it's nice. Maybe it inclines me to a little bit more fatalistic attitude than I have in New York. But I think what it does is I'm not afraid in Italy as I am in New York, since everything in Italy seems to be what it has to be. I mean, it seems almost ordained. And I think that's the effect of an older civilization. Whereas this one, so new, and also to me, it seems to me so tragic at this point in our history. Perhaps it doesn't have a long way to go.
You write that to change one's place is to change one's nature. And I think a lot of us feel when we travel that we've been somehow transformed by the experience. And then we wonder as we take that journey home, how much of that is going to stay with you? And how much will you just immediately fall into all the same patterns as before and become exactly who you were before? What have you found? How much does that sense of change last when the trip is over?
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. One is to get a frequent flyer bonus ticket so you can keep going back and getting a new fix. No, I think it sticks. I think I lived in India for 4 years. That certainly stuck. I mean, I think about poverty and about human suffering in ways that I might not had I not lived in India. But Italy, I think, once it transforms you, truly does. The effect it had on me and continues to have on me is a deep happiness, which amounts to a kind of praise. I'm so glad it's there. It just seems incredible to me that one can just get on a plane and be there. And you know, people have found it transforming and are usually, I may say, when they're not scribbling, I mean, most of us who scribble about Italy are far more articulate on the page than we are when we're babbling alive. They've all felt transformed. It is the transforming country, and it just does something freeing and wonderful. And that's a combination of light, air, food, people, landscape, art. It all comes together in the most beautiful and human way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks.
It was fun, Terry. Thank you.
Barbara Gerzuti-Harrison's new book, Italian Days, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. Her articles appear in such magazines as The New York Times, Esquire, Ms., and Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk about writing biography with Michael Holroyd. His latest work is a biography of George Bernard Shaw. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman describes her job as trying to make sense of things. Coming up, we talk about making sense of recent political and cultural changes from her perspective as journalist, mother, daughter, and wife. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz discusses interpretation by comparing different performances of the same compositions. And book critic John Leonard reviews Thomas McGuane's new novel, Keep the Change. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Samuel Pierce was on Capitol Hill today. He appeared before a House committee investigating scandals and mismanagement at HUD, where he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights and refused to answer questions. NPR's Mara Liasson has more from Capitol Hill.
Pierce told committee members that he felt they had rushed him to appear before he'd had time to prepare, and that they had prejudged him before they had heard his testimony. For those reasons, he said, he decided to accept the advice of his counsel and assert his right under the Constitution to refuse to answer questions. The chairman of the committee, Tom Lantos, went ahead and began to question Pierce anyway about several HUD transactions where Pierce is alleged to have exercised political favoritism. To each question, Pierce repeated his statement that he was invoking his Fifth Amendment rights. Outside the hearing room, Pierce's attorneys said they hoped to bring Pierce back before the committee in October, fully prepared to testify. Committee members, meanwhile, threatened to call for a special prosecutor if Pierce continues to remain silent. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Citing a lack of evidence, a judge in Colombia has reportedly dropped kidnapping and other charges against two men alleged to be leaders of the country's international drug network. A newspaper in Colombia reports a judge in Medellin dropped charges against two men on a list drawn up by the U.S. Justice Department of the key drug figures wanted for prosecution in the United States. Meanwhile, the military has imposed heavy security on the tourist city of Cartagena after a bomb explosion killed two people there. President Bush is back at the White House today following several days of what the Bush administration describes as progress on foreign relations. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more from the White House.
Yesterday, in a speech before the United Nations, the president proposed an 80% reduction in U.S. chemical weapons if the Soviets cut them to the same level. Today, also in a speech before the UN, Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze called for the total elimination of U.S. and Soviet chemical weapons. President Bush said he welcomed the Soviet response.
The reaction from the Soviets to our proposals yesterday has been positive. And so now the goal is to get moving and try to work out these agreements.
President Bush says there is now what he called good common ground that wasn't there before the Soviet foreign minister's visit. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 4.5 points to close at 2,663.94 on volume of some 157 million shares. Gaining stocks outpaced losers by 7-6. There was only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A few weeks ago, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was talking to me about some turning points in his understanding of music and how he came to appreciate different performances of the same composition. Today he shares some of his thoughts and plays some of his favorite music.
When I first started collecting records, I didn't care who was performing. I only wanted to hear the music. Of course, I knew that some musicians let you hear more of the music than others, or made more of it sound beautiful. But how did you find the ideal recording, the one which allowed the most music to come through? At first, I used to think this sort of performance, what the record companies like to call definitive, meant the most impersonal and literal reading of a score, the performance with the highest level of technical finish, untainted by anything quirky or eccentric in the interpretation. Later, I came to realize that impersonal and literal didn't necessarily make a piece interesting or alive. I remember a recording of Schumann's Third Symphony, the Rhenish, that a record store salesman had recommended. I'd heard the piece on the radio and wanted to hear it again, over and over. The recording I got was with George Zell and the Cleveland Orchestra, perfectly executed and in beautiful sound. Then one day, a friend played me the version conducted by Toscanini. The sound was poor, but the opening bars made my heart pound with excitement. The whole symphony was more exhilarating, more rhythmically daring than I'd ever imagined. The Zell performance seemed academic and bland in comparison. Was it really more faithful to Schumann? Here's how Zell begins. Now listen to Toscanini conducting the NBC Symphony in the same passage. I still thought a great piece of music could be embodied in a single performance. The definitive Schumann Third was surely Toscanini's. But I remember a listening session with my best friend in graduate school. He had a large collection, and we were comparing three very different recordings of Mozart's 40th symphony, the tragic G minor. Which one was best? In Toscanini's version, the first movement, marked Allegro Molto, had a powerful forward thrust, high-speed tension with a suppleness of phrasing that characterizes Toscanini at his best. Wilhelm Furtwängler was even faster, but more interior, nervous, almost manic. In their different ways, Toscanini and Furtwängler were both doing what Mozart indicated. But what were we supposed to make of the perversely slow tempo taken by Otto Klemperer? How could that be Mozart's Allegro Molto? It was more like an Andante. Yet I'd never heard anyone so vividly capture Mozart's profound pathos. Klemperer's slowing down was like an X-ray that revealed both the skeleton and the heart of the music. At the time, I disapproved, but I couldn't get the performance out of my head. I think it's still my favorite version of the G minor. Each of these conductors is obviously passionately committed to his own deep understanding of the music. And each view adds crucial elements to our own understanding. Aren't they all closer to the spirit of Mozart, to the spirit of music, than the anonymous perfection of a definitive performance? How can we choose only one when each one is indispensable and definitive?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. Here's more of Otto Klemperer conducting Mozart. This is Fresh Air. In the introduction to her fourth collection of newspaper columns, Ellen Goodman writes, "Newspapers are as transient as the day. They tell what has happened in the last 24 hours, but I have spent most of my career in the corner of that world, trying to wrestle meaning out of those daily stories." Ellen Goodman has been a journalist for 25 years. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning column for the Boston Globe is syndicated to 400 newspapers. Since she started her column in 1971, Goodman has chronicled the social and political changes of her time. One recent column was about the disturbing change she saw while walking on the streets of Philadelphia. On every corner, she was confronted by someone asking her for money. I asked her how this experience became a column.
When things happen in your life, some of them are trivial, obviously, and some of them are tremendously personal and have no larger meaning. But when you come across something that you know resonates, and that's a very subjective decision, but you know it resonates with what other people have experienced, and you know that it hits a spot. And the point of that column was, hey, you know, we've all seen a lot of this happening, but enough's enough. When you can't walk through a city without getting hassled on every street corner, not by people who are homeless and need shelter. Those people should certainly be sheltered, but by people who are hustling and by people who are pushing against you for a couple of bucks to feed their alcohol or drug problem, and who have changed the entire tenor of a city so that ordinary citizens no longer want to go to dinner in that city. That city's got a serious problem. And that's true not just for Philadelphia, but for other parts of other cities.
Did you think, am I becoming hard-hearted or insensitive by saying this? Did that go through your mind before you wrote it?
No.
Right, okay.
Not really. It does, I think you have to... What my male colleagues who use metaphors, sports metaphors, interminably would say, you got to step up to the plate. And you have to, these are all sports metaphors, which I abhor, but you have to call them the way you see them. I could give you a whole other range of them before I ran out of my knowledge of, of football, baseball, et cetera. I'd probably start mixing them at some point. But
well, I want to ask you a few things about your life. You are now very confident to take a stand on whatever issue you decide to write about. Were you sure of yourself back when you were in high school? Were you confident about expressing opinions in the classroom or with friends?
Do you know anybody who is sure of herself at 14? If you find one, I'll save the city a lot. I think that to a certain degree in my home, my father in particular, my father was a lawyer and he had a style of conversation, which was also debate. I mean, that was his format. I don't mean that he wasn't also loving and cheerful and funny, because he was all of that. But when he discussed issues, and issues were discussed a lot in our household, you couldn't get away with a sort of wishy-washy statement about it. You were generally in the midst of a fairly strong debate about it. And I lost most of those debates, certainly with my father, until I was maybe 16, 17, and stopped having them. But it hones your helps your arguments to a certain extent. And then I think just on-the-job training, you become a journalist, and the process of going from being a reporter, where you say what other people think, to being a columnist, where you say what you think, is a process of honing that and feeling comfortable with it. And you also get a lot of grief. If you say what you think, people will tell you what they think of what you think. And you have to be able to handle that. And that is much easier as you get older than when you are young.
Your columns address the personal and the political. They address what's happening in the White House, all the political issues of the day. But they also look at what's happening in people's offices, what's happening in their home lives, how are the generations getting along. Did you find it was difficult at first to be able to combine the personal and the political in one column?
Well, I have to tell you, that was my intent from the beginning, professionally. When I started out, you could either write an op-ed page column, which was Walter Lippmann. It was on the Walter Lippmann model. Or you could write about intimate life or personal life, which was on the Irma Bombeck model. And those are two wonderful models, but there was nobody who was allowed to cross that. Now, I started working really along with the women's movement. If you remember the women's movement slogan, the personal is political,
mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that it was very important not to dissect life. I mean, you and I would get up in the morning and you worry about, you know, washing your hair and finding clean clothes and whether the SNLs are going to fold. I mean, we worry about all of these things simultaneously, or we think about them all in the course of a life. And to say, no, I can't write about how people are dealing with raising their children, how anxious we are all about the future, and write about the greenhouse effect. It just seems to me important to cover all of those. So even though at first it was sort of an aberration and a lot of newspapers didn't know, quote, where to put it, end quote, that was a deliberate decision of mine that I wouldn't write one or the other, but that I would try to express the range of things we all care about. That was a very long answer to your question. I apologize.
I want to ask you about an observation that you made in one of your columns. You said, men are at a disadvantage by not having menopause.
I know.
I thought that was very interesting.
It drove people crazy.
Well, elaborate on that for us, for our listeners who haven't read your column.
Well, one of the things I think that's happened in life is this kind of postponing of decisions. And one of the major decisions that's been postponed is that of child rearing. And the column that you're referring to is one that I wrote about a number of men that I knew who were pushing aside and forever the decision about whether they were going to have children, or they kept it in the future. And now here they were coming along. They're in their 40s now. And they still didn't have that sense of urgency about making a decision that women have. Women have a biological clock, and it gives them a certain sensible relationship to the life cycle and to the human life cycle. And I think in some perverse way, even though women have come to see it as something of a disadvantage often, in some perverse way, the biological alarm of menopause is a very healthy reminder and a very healthy deadline. And that men don't always have that. And so they sort of can sometimes slip around and not make decisions and end up missing a lot in life.
You are on the Sunday morning Brinkley show quite a bit.
I'm in the rotation.
I wonder what that experience has been like.
I'm in the visitor's chair.
Right. But you know, you were so used to, I know you do a lot of public speaking, but still most of your work is on the page where you can think every word out beforehand. And suddenly there you are on TV, having to express it all verbally and also be visible. And I know a lot of people in both newspapers and radio enjoy their invisibility. So how have you been liking the experience of being visible and verbal?
Visible and hopefully verbal. Definitely visible. I think it's pretty good. It makes you think on your feet. I've never really found myself uncomfortable with that. Occasionally, I found myself, you know, in the situation in that show of being the skirt. And
right.
You know, Cokie Roberts, who also does the show, and I have talked and laughed about it at various times. And in fact, one day we were both on, which probably set the record for the program. There were actually two women at the same morning. It must have been quite a shock. But it's fun to sit there between George Will and Sam Donaldson and see if you get to actually say anything.
Ellen Goodman, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman, her new collection of columns, Making Sense, is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
The two top stories for us today, Terry, are the HUD scandal and the response to the president's speech at the United Nations by the Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze. Sam Pierce, who was President Reagan's Secretary of Housing, finally testifies before a House committee, but nobody will take any pictures or make any recordings of that testimony. We're also going to check out capital gains at the Capitol and see how that's progressing. Shevardnadze, apparently in his speech at the United Nations, saw the president and raised the president. We'll have more on that and on a demonstration for reform in East Germany.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Thomas McGuane writes about outlaws, outcasts, and the great outdoors in screenplays like The Missouri Breaks and Cold Feet, and novels including The Sporting Club, The Bushwhacked Piano, and Panama. Book critic John Leonard says in McGuane's new novel, Keep the Change, the author and his characters have come of age.
When Tom McGuane's first novel, The Sporting Club, was published 20 years ago, most of the reviewers mentioned Scott Fitzgerald. I did too. I thought The Sporting Club was better, in fact, than This Side of Paradise. Equally intoxicating, but less romantic, with a scourging quality. Imagine a kind of archaeology of the propertied Midwestern upper classes. Digging up their past, McGuane found pornography. Under the Celtic rainbow of a loving language grinned a savage social critic. But he went away in the novels that followed, to Key West and Montana and Hollywood. And by the time he got to Panama in 1978, he seemed to disdain any sort of social context. More like Hemingway than Fitzgerald. His gun-toting anti-heroes, wherever they found themselves, even in bed with a bimbo, were alone in their heads and in their bottles and in their private codes of behavior, disenchanted and contemptuous, cowboy Beckets. It was very existential and somehow unearned and thus depressing, like a hangover from a party to which the reader hadn't been invited. Keep the Change is a recovery and a triumph. At first glance, Joe Starling looks like another of these cowboys, a 30-something failed artist, feeling bad about himself in Key West. He steals his girlfriend's car and drives cross-country home to Montana to wrestle with some ghosts. These ghosts include Joe's banker father, who died of alcoholism, his aunt and uncle, who mismanage a ranch that was left to Joe, his first love, with whom he may have sired a child, horses and Indians, and a painting of white hills in the abandoned mansion of a bygone silver king. Whatever it was, he says to himself, that had pushed him from one place to another was not going to push him any farther. He couldn't understand why, when he looked within, as he had done for so long in his apprenticeship, he found nothing he could use. He thinks about the land and who really owns it, about sex and property rights, about fathers and the past as a series of foreclosures. he thinks also about those white hills in that painting, which he plagiarized for his own art, now abandoned like the mansion. He comes to conclusions. I quote, "Something went through him with signifying interior chime, as powerful as looking at an empty bed where a parent once died." Later on, things seemed so right to Joe, he was able to enfold himself in the breaking wave. It was not necessary now to have an opinion about anything. Finally, it was this Joe had waited for, something that would cross his mind like a change of weather and leave a different atmosphere behind. It's not just that Keep the Change is very funny. Driving westward, Joe spots a born-again bumper sticker. "The game is fixed," it says. "The lamb will win. Be there." Nor that for the first time McGuane gives us women that we care about, two of them. Nor that he's never been better at evoking landscape, livestock, and all the weathers of the night. It's not even that the painting has a secret and the plot a surprise twist. It's more that this humming language soars to a music of liberation, a death-defying leap into nameless possibilities in unknown, unclaimed, unspoiled places of the heart. No more cowboys and Indians. On the range instead, a powerful artist, an adult.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Keep the Change by Thomas McGuane. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Shorrock and Allison Dufty. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the dead can inform the living with the help of a good biographer. Michael Holroyd has just completed the second in his 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw. Also, scenes from a hospital emergency room by photojournalist Eugene Richards. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.